Welcome to Westerns with Dad. This is Matt.
And this is Dad.
And today we will be talking about Ride the High Country, a Sam Peckinpah film, one of his first films, I believe his first Western.
Yep, second film overall, I think.
1962? Sorry?
Second film overall, I think.
Right, yes. 1962 film starring Joel McRae and Randolph Scott of Seven Men From Now fame.
That's right. First time Joel McRae, though. First time we've done a Joel McRae movie.
That's true. I'm not familiar with Joel McRae, to be honest. This may be the first film I've seen with Joel McRae.
Really?
I think. Yeah,
He did a ton of Westerns.
In looking into him for this, I realized that, yeah. Like, I was familiar with the name, but I couldn't put a face to it. And yeah, I hadn't really seen much of him, but which was true of Randolph Scott a year ago, actually. And so it's good to be filling in these gaps in my education of the genre. And also Sam Peckinpah. This is the first Sam Peckinpah film that we've talked about on the podcast, which is kind of amazing, really. This one doesn't really feel like what I associate with Sam Peckinpah, I gotta say.
No, he was developing his style, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, this feels more like a John Ford film, really, to me. And also, it has the, it doesn't have any Wild Bunch in this. The closest this comes to reminding me of the Wild Bunch is Warren Oates being in it, in a supporting role. but other than that, it feels, you know, like a very old-fashioned film. 1962, I believe, is the year. It feels more like, you know, the older Randolph Scott films or
the 50s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It has. I was looking at some of the things online that people have written about it. They say that there is a revisionist edge to this. I didn't see that at all.
You got to look hard for it. You know. I mean, there's a dark side to Randolph Scott's character, for example.
There is, and that was very interesting. Actually, probably one of my favorite things in the film is Randolph Scott not being a total good guy in this. That was great. Uh-huh. Yeah. Joel McRae is, but and it does kind of resemble a little bit of Unforgiven, which, I mean, I use that as a blanket term. It doesn't feel like Unforgiven at all, but it is the aging gunslinger looking back on his life kind of aspect, which is in a lot of films.
Two aging gunslingers.
Indeed, yeah.
Well, and the dying of a genre, almost.
A little bit, yeah. It takes place sort of in the twilight of the Old West, which is a very good... I like that for a setting for a Western, you know, kind of... I don't think you get a specific year, but I'm betting definitely 20th century here.
Yeah.
You know?
Very early 20th
modernity
century.
Modernity is kind of creeping in, you know, along the corners. Randolph Scott starts the film. He's working as in a Wild West show. Dressed as Wild Bill Hickok. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Buffalo Bill Cody.
Yeah.
I don't know. And that's...
Which is interesting for Randolph Scott. I've never seen him dress up like that in any movie. He's always been Randolph Scott, wearing the same kind of shirts, the neckerchief, you know, usually a leather jacket that looks pretty worn. Always loved his leather jackets, by the way. And
you got a good one in this?
First time I've seen him, you know, with lots of makeup and, you know, fake hair and beard and everything.
It's great. And again, like we were just saying this, the surprising thing about this film is his character, I would say. Well, there's more than one surprising thing. It's a good movie. We'll get that out of the way right away. It's a really interesting film. This is a request episode, by the way. This was recommended to us. And I want to thank the recommendation because I was completely unfamiliar with this. I had never seen this before or even heard of it, really.
I'd seen it about a half a dozen times.
This is from a gentleman named Mark, and we appreciate the recommendation. So here it is. Finally, we're getting around to it. Thank you very much, Mark. And again, as a Randolph Scott performance, I believe when we did the last Randolph Scott, my first Randolph Scott, we talked about how I saw this guy was obviously just, he was this character every time, you know, that he was an avatar of justice. That was a guy who always did the right thing, kind of, and that very much seemed like his persona and why he was such a successful Western star. Not at all what he is in this.
Right.
I mean, we talked about wanting to see him play a bad guy at some point, that he'd have a kind of a good, merciless quality. That's not exactly what this is, though. This is a fully rounded character. You know, this is a guy who exists in the gray area, who has both good and bad in him. And
right.
And I would not have guessed this would be the kind of thing he'd pull off. He's the best thing in the movie, as far as I'm concerned. He's
I agree.
Great.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what I was going to say. As a matter of fact, it was the Randolph Scott performance that I always loved about this movie. And he's in other Randolph Scott movies. He can play like he's done this over and over again, where he pretends to be a bad guy. You know, he infiltrates a gang, for example. You know, and then later we find out, okay, he's really a good guy. trying to get these guys, you know, in jail. But
kind of the opposite in this.
Yeah, this guy, he's a bad guy pretty much the whole way through. Finally redeems himself at the end.
Well, the way it's done, though, I mean, the way it is set up in the film is quite artful, actually, which is that we know there's something going on with him. Like, that we know he has some ulterior motive for what he's doing. But in the interactions he has with his sidekick, the kid...
Right, Heck.
He seems like the good guy. He seems like the measured, more...
wiser, older man.
Yeah, yes, and also kind of the one who wants to do right by everyone, you know? Who's I think I can make this work. You know, you just let me take care of him. He'll come around. You know,
saying right.
Enigmatic things like that, so as not to tip his hand at the end of the film. But when it comes down to it, though, he ends up being the harder edged one for sure. We'll talk about this in due time because there's a lot of stuff throughout the film. I mean, we're jumping ahead all over just to talk about Randolph Scott here.
Right.
but yeah, there's a whole other movie going on. He's barely... I was very interested to discover that the movers and shakers of this plot are not actually Joel McRae and Randolph Scott until the last half hour or so. Up until then, they're almost a Greek chorus.
yeah.
Yeah, following the exploits of the younger people. And that's what the movie largely centers around until late on.
Right, but also, I mean, you know that ultimately it's going to come around to Randolph Scott and Joel McRae. Because the way it's set up at the beginning.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. Randolph Scott finds out that there might be $250,000 up at this gold mining camp. You know, and it's not that obscure that he means to steal this money. You know?
Yeah. True. That's right. Yeah. So yeah, that is the basic premise of this. The story of Ride the High Country is an older lawman named Stephen Judd, played by Joel McRae, gets hired to move some gold from a mining camp back to the bank in the city. He hires extra help to do it, which is Randolph Scott and Randolph Scott's sidekick, friend, buddy, younger man, dude named Heck Longmire. Yeah. What's the actor on this? I'm not familiar.
Oh, Rick somebody.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He's not... It's not some exciting, like, whoa, it's a young Ron Howard or anything like that. No, it's just some... it's just some guy. it's them traveling to the mining camp, getting on adventures along the way, and... taking control of the money and then trying to decide what's going to happen at that point. And that is the film in a nutshell, I would say.
Except that the woman kind of complicates things.
Yeah, well, that is included in the umbrella term adventures along the way.
Oh, I see. okay.
Yeah.
okay. Yeah, women in the audience, and our audience, mate. I don't like
that. No, oh, this character, come on, this character, this is a movie for dudes. This, there's one woman in it, and she is a farmer's daughter archetype, through and through.
Farmer preacher, I guess, right? Or at least Bible student.
Man, we'll get to the farmer's daughter stuff, but I was pretty delighted by that when it came around. Don't you be speaking to my daughter. Yeah, all that. So, what do you think of this font at the beginning of the film?
Oh, I didn't notice the font.
Font review? Okay. It is a sort of a screaming yellow and green neon.
Is it a script kind of thing, or is it block letters?
Block letters, you know. Block letters. Filled in. Mm-hmm. Gross-looking green-yellow. Yeah.
Ride the high country.
Mm-hmm. Artless font. It is superimposed over, as the font tells us, Inyo National Park. This is a more beautiful, natural, mountains, cliffs, and trees, and valleys, and all the things that you associate with a Western of this era shot outside, which
is great. Always good. I can't get enough of it. No.
I feel like you don't see that as often anymore. I think you do, but you just don't see Westerns as often anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's striking how much of this is shot on location. Almost all of it. And that's something you get from the 60s Westerns. It's, I don't know, it almost feels like this is always the case. But yeah, this is a good-looking one, as they go.
Well, you know, we haven't done any B-movies. Seven Men from Now is like borderline B-A. But we haven't done any of the B-movies that, you know, like, any of the, Audie Murphy films, or
fair.
George Montgomery, or any of those guys, those B-movie guys.
We should probably do some of that for context, I suppose. I feel like watching a movie like Hondo, or, I feel like we've done some B-movies. Some of the lesser Wayne's.
The fact that John Wayne's in them, though, makes him an A-movie.
True. Okay, fair enough. So yeah, let's watch. We'll put a pin in Audie Murphy.
Audie Murphy.
And
Fort Petticoat, for example. There's a classic.
We can do it. Right around the same time we do a Gene Autry.
There we go.
Singing cowboy. Yeah. go for a really exciting month and do both of them. No, that's the point, though. We want to do that. We want to approach the breadth of the genre, and that would be a big part of it. Just the straight-up programmers. I don't know. Here's the thing, though. In researching this film, this was released as the second half of a double bill. This was a double feature you sent this straight to the drive-ins. It played right after a film called The Tartars, starring Orson Welles, which apparently is terrible. Yeah. That was the release strategy for this.
They were made to be a double bill?
Well, I don't know if they were made to do that, but they were released that way. Like, it was a double header. Yeah. Wow. That was some sort of, medieval adventure epic thing that didn't work at all, I guess. It's even harder
to... Wow, that's weird.
No one's heard of The Tartars anymore, but yeah.
Reminds me of a double bill I saw in the theater as a kid, Moby Dick and the Wizard of Oz.
That's a great double bill.
It's a great bill, but they have nothing in common, those two films. It's just weird.
Well, yeah, not really. It's the Gregory Peck Moby Dick.
Gregory Peck Moby Dick, yeah.
Well, could that just be a situation where Moby Dick came out and they were just like, throw Wizard of Oz on the end, you know?
That's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was.
We want people to come, after all.
Yeah.
That is a culture that I miss, or missed out on, rather, the double feature.
Yeah, I was gone by the time you came around.
I love the idea of that. I mean, I've certainly snuck into a movie after another movie because I didn't want to pay for it. Done that a number of times. That was huge back in my teenage, being a teenager. That was how you maximized your cash fund at the movie theater, or snuck into the R-rated movie afterwards.
Yeah, I remember going to the theater, paying a buck on a Saturday afternoon, and sitting there for hours. Watching a couple of movies and then watching them again.
Love it. That's a good day for me. Even now, in my 30s, that's like, I wish I could do that. I guess the difference is I just wish I could do that. I haven't done it in a very long time. But, yeah, it sounds great.
You used to be able to flatten your popcorn box and throw it like a Frisbee. At the end of the movie, all the kids in the theater would flatten their popcorn boxes and throw them up at the screen. Mm. Pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, you can't get more popcorn then. Or would they even do that?
Nope. No free refills.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
But popcorn was a dime, you know? I mean...
You know how much it is now?
What? For a tub, how much?
Oh, it's at like $7 at least.
Jeez.
Probably, let's say around $7, sure. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I got one when we went and saw Wonder Woman last week. Very expensive. It's a good movie, you see it?
Yeah, nope, we'll talk about that later, good. I suppose.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll talk about it later. Okay. As we mentioned before, this film opens after the credits over the National Forest at a circus or a Wild West show kind of situation. Not one that they've really spent a lot of money on. Very little film takes place here, so they didn't fully build this. But they were presenting they're showing like a strong man and a snake charmer and things like that. And it is established that there is a Wild West Fair in this town. And then Joe McRae rides into town and thinks everyone is out cheering for him. But nope, turns out they're excited about the camel race that is happening. And he is ushered off the street so the camels can race by.
Right. And this is where you get an idea of roughly the time frame of this movie. With the Keystone cops telling him to get off the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the twilight of gunslingers and the Old West. I guess that's just what the Wild West show says to me now. That is the semiotics of seeing a Buffalo Bill Cody kind of, when they started merchandising and marketing the Old West as a thing. That is a visual clue to me that we're at the end of it, we're in the the afterglow of the Old West at this point,
right,
and where all the old gunslingers have kind of turned into they've become showmen, trying to sell their legacy, and that is indeed what Randolph Scott is doing at this point,
right,
as the Oregon Kid.
Right.
With his, he's got a huge, huge mustache and a big wig and all that, and it's fun to see Randolph Scott doing that, as you said.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. The guy on the camel who won the race, we kind of meet him. That ends up being Heck Longmire, who is, as we were saying, a buddy of Randolph Scott's character, and also both of them are kind of light con artists. In the name of, just sort of like Carney. Not out and out con men, but sort of, showmen.
Is it Jay Leno that talked about Carneys and them throwing off spores? Carney spores.
Well, they are gross.
Anyway.
Traditionally, carnies are gross. I mean, I don't know. I feel like we're already a bit digression heavy, so I
yeah,
don't know
sorry. If okay, go off on okay, carnies, go ahead. But
you get some good carny action at the beginning of this film for sure. Basically, Joel McRae has already in the business, already been contracted to move this money, and now he's just looking for help. So so he gets up with Randolph Scott, whose character is Gil Westrum, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, Gil. And basically, you know, tells him, here's the deal. This is what I'm looking to do. And are you interested? And he plants the seed there. He says it's $250,000 in gold. And then when he goes and meets with the bankers, turns out it's more like $20,000.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing in this movie. Everyone assumed this was an enormous amount of money, and it ends up being a lot less. And the disappointment of that, but then they're just like, well, I guess we're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't really change much, I guess, because we're kind of desperate. I mean, and that's the legitimate purposes for it, and for the and as thieves. Yeah. And there's a long scene of Joel McRae's Stephen Judd going and talking to the bankers and haggling over his share.
Well, trying to convince them that he's not too old.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think we're supposed to share Joel McRae's disgust with them, being, you know, sort of pansy money men, you know? Just,
right.
He's kind of grossed out by them just being money guys, you know? Of the gunslinger stock that he is.
You think that's why he goes into the bathroom and flushes the toilet?
I think so, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. That is a... He takes the contract and says, I'm going to read this by myself. And then he just goes into the bathroom and just sort of kills some time in there and flushes the toilet and,
Well, he pulls out his glasses, so he didn't want to pull out his glasses in front of the bankers.
Oh, that's part of it. It is all games, though. It's all gamesmanship, and
right.
Uh-huh. And as you see a lot in these movies, masculinity tests. There's a lot of those in there too. Yeah. Less overt in this one, but it's just sort of cooked into the DNA of this genre. I would say there's a lot of braving one another.
You see a lot of that machismo when you get to the gold camp.
Oh, man. Those guys are out of control, yeah. Anyway, so Steve Judd meets with Gil Westrum and Gil's buddy Heck at a bar to kind of finalize this deal and make sure that they're willing to work for him. They'll be getting $10 to his $20. And was this $10 and $20 a day or for the whole thing?
A day.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I do believe.
Yeah. And... which seems like not much to everyone, but again, they're, you know, what are they going to do? I guess is the logic. They're desperate, you know, scammers looking for whatever the next thing is. There is a bar fight that just sort of breaks out.
Over the camel race, right?
Yeah, over Hex camel race. Because it was sort of a light scam, or maybe they were just mad about getting beat by a camel.
But it was kind of a scam, as pointed out by Joel McRae, who said that no horse could beat a camel at that distance.
Yeah. But is that a scam, or is that more just like, well, you know, that's part of the show. That's information you don't need to share. Of course you're going to lose to the camel. Yeah. So, initially... Heck is not impressive because he's not really paying attention. He's just sort of watching girls, and his decorum and behavior in the fight is what finally allows Joel McRae to sign off on him for joining the team.
Right.
Which sets up that he's sort of a horn dog, I guess.
A horn dog?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wait a minute. What's a horn dog?
You don't have a horn dog as a colloquial term?
Oh, a womanizer.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Horn dog. Okay.
Well, yeah. It's a combination of horny and dog, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured that out.
So they're off.
A combination of horny and dog.
They're off to Coarse Gold, I believe, is the name.
Coarse Gold. Mining
camp. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's where the money that they're picking up is, the gold. And along the way, they come up to a ranch out in the middle of nowhere, out in the sticks, that is manned by a farmer and his sexy young daughter. Yeah. He's super religious, and she is bridling at having to stay out here in the mountains away from everyone and dealing with her super religious dad, who's pretty gross, kind of a gross guy. This is character actor R.G. Armstrong. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Shows up in a lot of old westerns.
Yeah, I only knew him as a really old guy, actually. You know, because he was still making movies in the 80s and into the 90s.
That's right.
And that's where I saw him, you know.
I seem to remember him in Charles Bronson movies as well.
That seems like a good place for him. I remember him from Predator, mostly.
Oh.
And he's an old guy at the beginning of Predator, old sergeant, and I think he's in Dick Tracy. he talks a bunch about sin and gold and the Bible here, he says they can have one egg because what is it?
Part of the Lord's bounty.
Yeah.
The Lord's bounty is free. The first egg is part of the Lord's bounty, but then it's a dollar an egg after that.
Mm-hmm. He has them into dinner, but then, you know, during the grace he makes them all say, he, you know, complains again about gold and sin and forgive these men for the base desires that drive them on this job. his daughter, this is Elsa Knudsen. Knudsen is the name of the farmers here, and she's introduced kind of as like a tomboy, you know, working the farm. She's got a boy haircut, which apparently her father made her get so she'd be less attractive to others. And she comes out wearing a fancy dress at first, and the dad screams at her that she has to change it because he is terrified of his daughter's sexuality and wants to hide it from the world.
Did you get from the movie at all any incestuous overtones?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That was intriguing. I mean, it's not really a thing in the movie, but man, there's a scene where it was just like, ooh, whoa, what's going on here? Whoa, this is unexpected.
Oh, maybe that's what makes it when he chases Heck away?
He chases Heck away. It's when he's got her cornered and
in the house, back in the house.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right.
It's after he catches him outside.
Right.
You know? They're doing some like Caddyshack shenanigans over by the hay cart. You know, like, oh, I didn't want. Oh, hi there, Elsa. Hi, I just thought I'd meet you out here, kind of stuff. And Heck's going hard for her.
He is.
Heck is going He's out of his way to kind of, you know, get this girl to talk to him, and he's trying to charm her. And yeah, the dad catches it, you know, and he kind of loses his mind about it. And he's got this weird, like, creepy thing for his daughter, it seems like.
It comes out in that conversation in the house when he slaps her.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Right? And then apologizes.
Yeah, it turns out she's engaged, allegedly, against her father's will. She says that she has her intended. His name is Billy. He's in Coarse Gold. He's a miner. And, Dad doesn't really approve of this, turns out. He's like, you don't approve of any boys, Dad. It seems like you want me all to yourself. And he slaps her. And, you know, then, like, grabs her by the face. And I'm sorry. It's... This incestuous thing that you picked up on, that I picked up on, is not text. It's not officially part of the film. It's not part of the narrative in any way.
Nope.
But it's... Ooh, there's a hint of it.
There's an overtone.
Definitely... Mm-hmm. There's a weird smell when they're together. and yeah, I thought that was actually fascinating. I thought like this. Okay, first off, the farmer's daughter thing. You know, these two characters appear to have walked right out of a traveling salesman joke. You know, like, it is as archetypal a setup for these two characters, as you could imagine. I mean, like, he's like, yeah, you can stay the night, but you stay away from my daughter. You know, couldn't be more dirty joke stylings, but they really go for it here, you know, now, what were Joel McRae and Randolph Scott doing through this? Mostly just
hanging out in the barn.
Yeah. Yeah. They wax philosophical about it a little bit. Yeah, you know, they do remember when. They play remember when, you know. You know, yeah. you used to chase after girls once, you know, stuff like that.
Well, they Joel McRae actually goes back and forth with the with Knudsen on the Bible. Each trying to support their own point of view by excerpts from the Bible.
Yeah, because he
seems like they always go to Proverbs, but you can support anything with a proverb there.
So this is kind of like the Unforgiven stuff, you know, that I was they're old man, look at my life, I'm a lot like you were kind of stuff. Well, they they just sort of hang out in the barn wearing old tiny old man long underwear. I mean, they're very reactive for a long chunk of this film, for the most part. They're not driving any of this stuff with the daughter, certainly, even as that becomes most of the film later.
Not until they get to the gold camp.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is where we're starting to get hints that Heck and Gil kind of have ulterior plans, you know. Like, Heck is pretty sure they're gonna have to do something about Joel McRae, and Randolph Scott keeps saying, like, nope, he'll come around. You leave it to me, that sort of thing.
yeah. Which is, you know, he's sort of... I mean, if it were a true Peckinpah film from later versions, he wouldn't try and make him come around. He'd just kill him. You know? Mm-hmm. Seems to me that the later Peckinpah films are much more direct.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is not a bad guy in the end.
Right.
Ish, you know, and I mean, that's the story being told here. I guess that's why I say it feels more John Ford than Sam Peckinpah. Hmm. I mean, this is Peckinpah kind of learning his craft, I would say. You know, this is him figuring out how to shoot a Western, how to tell a story. And, I mean, in a sense, it's a kind of film anyone could have done despite being very good. It's, it has no real directorial voice, you know, I would say.
Hmm.
Certainly not once you know what Peckinpah's voice is. It doesn't have too much of a opinion on who you're supposed to root for. I kind of like that. You know, it's just telling a story of these people.
Well, I'd say that Joel McRae is the ultimate source of virtue in the film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, but to what end? Like, to what value is that virtue? Does that make him more protagonist than Gil, ultimately, than Randolph Scott?
Ultimately, they end up on the same level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But Joel McRae, he's steadfast throughout. He wants... What is the line? He said he wants to walk into his house feeling justified.
Yes, that's a key line, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you point out. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that is the beginning and the end of his philosophy, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Whereas I think Randolph Scott has a bit of a... I mean, part of why he's doing what he's doing is because he looks back and doesn't like what he sees very much. He's a more regretful kind of figure. You know, he doesn't particularly like scrounging for at con games at the carnival. And he's looking for one last score. Yeah.
Right.
Which, you know... And if it can't be 250,000, well, I guess 11,000 will do.
Yeah. That's what it ends up being, right?
Yeah, it's not even 20,000. It's like 11,000. Yeah.
11,000.
So they're off. They're heading out. You know, they want to get away from this weird farmer's daughter situation. And this is, you know, so they leave, and then we stay at the farm for a little bit for more creepiness, which is the Elsa, the farmer's daughter, decides to run away while her dad is praying at mom's gravesite. And by the way, mom's grave.
That was weird. Yeah.
Oh, man. What a creep this guy is.
Well, you get the idea that mom was a wayward woman.
You definitely get that idea.
By the quote about harlots and stuff?
Yeah.
Right? From the Bible?
He's got a quote about harlots and adultery, you know, etched into her tombstone. It's Good show. All right. So, yeah. Elsa runs and meets them, and she's like, take me to Coarse Gold. I want to marry my husband, you know, marry my fiancé. And they're like, okay.
Well, Hex all for it, but the old timers don't want her. Mm-hmm. Initially,
they don't want it. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And Hex says, "Well, if she, I'm with her. If she doesn't go, I don't go."
Mm-hmm. An emotional young man decision, to be sure.
Yep.
Then there's a very strange scene where Heck is continuing his courtship of Elsa, who is, you know, talking about how much she's not into it and wants her husband, and he kind of forces himself on her, starts kissing her and pulls her down to the ground, and she's screaming no, and I was just like, wow, I did not expect a sexual assault from him at this point in the film.
Yeah.
The old guys show up and, you know, they yank him off her and start beating on him a little bit, And this is a bit of a boys will be boys kind of thing. Like, this is something he's kind of, the movie and the characters let him off the hook on this real quick. I guess it had a different context.
Yeah, they did.
In 1962. I mean, this was sort of like a sailor's home from shore leave kind of attitude, right?
Well, he gets shut down pretty quickly.
He does, yes. Uh-huh.
Before he can get to second base.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's it doesn't play especially well now. And for a film that, you know, that just presented, you know, the dad, this daughter's father almost sexually assaulting her, and for all the borderline sexual assault towards her yet to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
it's a weird moment, I think. I think it has to be, you know, kind of linked to the fact that this movie is 55 years old at this point. You're not supposed to dislike this character after he does this. And yeah, she comes right up to him like 2 minutes later in the movie. It's just like, I'm sorry, I guess that whole thing was kind of my fault. Who is this actress?
Mariette Hartley.
I didn't recognize her. She's good. She's real good.
It was her first movie.
Was it her last movie? I've never
seen her. She was in a lot of stuff. She was Vero told me she was a former Playboy bunny.
No way. Yeah. Wow. Hmm.
Turned actress.
Okay.
And she's in a lot of TV shows, too.
Hmm. All right.
From the '70s and '80s.
Yeah, she's pretty, but like not, you know, unconventionally pretty. It might be, you know, the tomboy haircut and clothes they have her on in this, but she's, you know,
right,
she has a different look than I usually, you know, see from a 1960 film, and I think that's cool.
Her look changes completely when she smiles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she's definitely very pretty, but I liked her, this performance. I liked every performance, really. Even Heck, I thought he was pretty good.
Yeah.
Good.
Even the Hammond boys.
Yes. Well, Warren Oates is one of them.
Yep. Warren Oates. John Anderson, the elder.
And L.Q. Jones.
L.Q. Jones.
L.Q. Jones, right? You remember L.Q. Jones?
No.
Oh, he's...
I remember you mentioning the name. Where have we seen
him? Hang Him High. He was one of the bad guys in Hang 'Em High, and
okay,
and a number of other things as well. So, here they get to Coarse Gold. They get all the way to Coarse Gold. It's sort of an outdoor market. You know, this place is, I mean, this is a mining camp, you know, not in the sense like it's a town, as in it's like there is one structure in the whole place, and it's a brothel. Yeah. You know, this is sort of, it really is just a place where people are kind of, you know, a large-scale summer, like, campground, I guess. Like, no one's, you know, it's all, everyone has tents, you know, that, and they've opened it up as sort of mercantile system going on, but it's not, nothing's been built yet except a brothel.
Kate's place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Heck takes Elsa off to meet her intended, Billy, and, you know, the older guys are kind of just like, this isn't really our business. You go take care of it. And so he takes them out to find Billy. Billy, what was the Hammond?
Hammond. Yep.
He's the miners that are working the area, and they're a bunch of rowdy guys, basically.
Rowdy, put it mildly. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of testosterone, a lot of hooping and hollering, and no women around, so they're all kind of, you know.
They get a little randy.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They get a little
real
randy.
Horn dogs. And they're big assholes too.
Right, horn dog assholes.
Mm-hmm. Like Heck rides, yeah, you know, rides the his Billy's fiance into the camp, and they're immediately, oh, what are you after, Billy? What are you doing here, Heck? What do you want? Well, you were spending the night with her out in the woods, weren't you? Ooh, Heck. And they're like throwing rocks at him and stuff, like big rocks, and just sort of chase him out like gorillas, basically. It's just like,
yeah.
It's sort of a WTF moment, and immediately I was like, oh, well, I guess they're the bad guys, huh? These guys must be the villains, yeah. And they are, as it turns out. Yeah, Elsa is immediately like, oh.
Big mistake, ooh. Big mistake, yep.
Yeah, he takes her into his tent. Right away, you know, they bodily picks her up and takes her into the tent, and when we end up just like staying with them for a while after Heck leaves to kind of see what these guys are about, and yeah, she's he's taking her in, and he's like, yeah, it's my wedding night, hey, what's going? And there's the guy who's in there with him. I think he made them a gift. Is that right? Like,
oh, he made a sign. This is the honeymoon house.
He made a sign for the tent. Says the honeymoon house, and then they're like, yeah, yeah, well, it's my honeymoon now, we're about to be married. It's like, okay, so you want to leave? No, I'm staying. His roommate, who made the honeymoon suite sign, refuses to leave, yeah.
But gets thrown out immediately.
Mm-hmm, yeah, punched out, in fact.
Yep.
Yeah. And so again, Elsa is almost sexually assaulted again by her fiance, and she kind of like tells him to get out of there because she's not quite ready. And then he goes out and has some, you know, more masculine competitions with his brothers,
right?
Including Warren Oates, who is dunked in a tank because he smells bad.
Yeah. I can't understand him not wanting to bathe for his brother's wedding.
Yeah, I mean, and the movie kind of becomes about these guys for like 15 minutes at this point.
Yeah,
like it's watching them just you know, hang out and grab ass one another,
degrade themselves. Yeah,
just act like a bunch of big dipshits and. And then then there's a wedding that night. Now we're gonna have a wedding, right away. And they, you know, they have a wedding dress for her. She looks real unhappy. But you know, I you wonder how this scenario came to be in the first place. Really, like who she thought this guy was, how they met. Like, what?
She just wanted to get the hell out of the house.
Yeah, creepy dad. That's right. That's yeah. Probably exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they're going to get married at a brothel. It's the only building anywhere nearby.
There's a judge in town.
Yeah, there is a processional walking towards it. It's really like a really good scene. I think with everyone singing, it feels authentic in a way. It's good, and it also, this is probably the best directed scene in the film, which is there's this weird like threat, sort of unspecified threat that hangs over the whole thing to her. You know, you can feel her getting more and more uncomfortable every second this scene goes on.
Because we've seen what the brothers are like.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's got a good, nice view.
It sort of goes beyond, you know, just sort of boys will be boys partying kind of vibe into something that's sort of vaguely dangerous and threatening in an unspecific way.
Right.
And I think there's little touches throughout that kind of exacerbate this, you know, that creep up on this, like the swastikas on the Indian blanket on the wall, stuff like that, that just seem a little off.
Wow.
You know, they're not Nazi swastikas. They're just sort of like, you know, the traditional swastika before Hitler got it, but it's just sitting there on the wall. And, you know, this is 1962, things like that. And, Or the madam at the brothel, you know, her enthusiasm was like, "Oh, hey, here's your bridesmaids," you know, has a bunch of whores come out and dressed in fancy dress. It's a very weird scene
in their bridesmaid dresses. Yeah,
yeah.
Looking for the right adjective to describe that scene, because it is threatening, but it's
never overt.
Never overt, but uneasy. There's an uneasiness about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know something's going to happen with these guys.
Yeah.
You know, that this marriage is not going to turn out well. You know, that Billy's not going to turn over a new leaf and be the ideal husband.
Mm-hmm.
And you worry about his siblings.
Yeah, one of them's Warren Oates, for God's sake.
Yeah, you got to worry about Warren Oates all the time.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, you know, all the brothers get a chance to kiss her, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And don't want to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, and there's the minister of the peace is this old drunk guy. Who's this actor? Is this
Edgar Buchanan.
Okay, I don't know him, but
he's sort of familiar looking.
Yeah, the guy marrying them is just drunk off his ass and
Judge Tolliver.
Mm-hmm. and I think that part of this is the threat of the wedding night, you know, being it's coming, you know, and who knows how many people that will entail. Not to be creepy about it, but that's sort of the implication of what's going on here.
Right.
And I think maybe that when people talk about how this is has a dips a toe in revisionist Western, I think it might have to do with the way that sexual assault is presented in this film, because it's all over the place in this film, and it hits in a way, you know, that it is significant. And it's what makes that scene where Heck kind of outsteps his bounds feel a little different, because the rest of it is, you know, it's a lot more obviously alarming. The stuff with her dad or the stuff in this scene is kind of like, you know, it's raw in a way that you don't often see in a 1960s film.
Right.
Certainly not a John Wayne Western. Or a Randolph Scott one, really.
Right.
As far as I can tell. So maybe it's, you know, touching closer to the Leone's kind of vibe. This stuff would fit right in Leone.
Yeah.
Yeah. She gets slapped around a little bit, you know, and finally the good guys show up to save the day. I mean, they've been sitting outside the brothel hearing this, you know, listening to the sounds.
She screams.
Yeah. That's what brought her in. They hear a scream, and then they show up, you know, and pull her out of the creepy brothel. Heck manages to punch Billy, that's the fiance, knocks him down. I'm like, nope, she's coming with us tonight. Sorry. You know.
Yep.
And that's how it stands for the night.
Well, Joel McRae, I mean, the reason they were able to get out of there is Joel McRae, you know, drew his gun.
Yeah.
And held it on him. So that's where the two old guys become involved with the woman.
And the film, really. And, yeah. Up to this point, it's mostly been, trading philosophies on the trail. Doing Remember right. When, again, you know, just thinking about the good old days, how this reminds me about what it used to be like. And
yeah, yeah.
And then they finally, they're stepping into this at this point. And making a, you know, earning the $20/$10 a day, I guess. Well, not really, because this has nothing to do with the gold.
No.
No one's trying to steal the gold from them. The brothers are never trying to steal that money, by the way. That's always an internal issue.
I wonder about Randolph Scott's. We don't get really a good feel for Randolph Scott's character in reaction to the woman. I mean, he ultimately convinces the judge to change his mind.
But, yeah.
But not really to help the woman out, but to make things easier for them to get out of town and for him to get the gold.
He's kind of a scoundrel. Like, he's, you know, kind of in it for himself kind of dude. And that's what's so interesting about him and Randolph Scott playing him. I mean,
yeah,
these guys could have switched roles easily, I feel like.
They did, actually. They were planned the other way.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that makes sense to me.
Wait a minute. Maybe it was the death at the end was planned the other way. That's what I was thinking of.
Interesting. I could see that being that almost feels like the more obvious way to go. I'm glad they went the way they did.
I am too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, one of them dies at the end. So here's something cool that happens. No, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, no one's going to listen to this unless they either A, have already seen the film, or B, don't care about how, you know, about being spoiled for it, because, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah, we do that pretty much regularly, don't we?
Well, it's our structure. It's what the show is. You know, like, okay, well, first off, you can't talk about a film without talking about the ending, really. You can't do an in-depth talk about a movie without saying this is how it ends and that is the narrative arc and this is why it works or doesn't. So, you know, we can't, you know, not talk about the ending because you don't want to ruin it for, you know. That's almost the least important thing.
Someone who's never seen the movie.
Yeah. So they put together something I wish they had spent more time on, frankly. The miners' court. To adjudicate what happened with the wedding, you know, whether it was legal or not.
Yeah, they did shorten that. You're right.
Oh, I would have loved to see a whole miner's court sequence. This film is short. This movie's an hour and a half. It could easily have afforded 10 minutes of miner's court. I want to see how that subculture functions. That would be interesting. And yeah, basically it comes down to, was it legal or not? Because if it's legal, oh, they own this woman then, basically, is what it comes to. And
that's right.
And yeah, the way this is resolved is it is one scene, which is Gil goes into the brothel and threatens the judge with a gun, takes the marriage license from him, and says, "You're going to lie when I ask you that. You know, you're going to tell him. You're going to tell him what is it that he gets him to lie about?"
Like, that he's not
qualified.
He's not qualified to do marriages in California or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. Uh-huh. And yeah, I mean, they bully him. Basically, they bully the judge into overturning, into lying and overturning his the marriage. And
right.
And I like that they do that. I like that it's pragmatic, you know? There's no use for this minor's court law. They're just like, whatever, we're just going to.
Yeah, and there he does that. There's the scene where he pulls the gun and does that with the judge. And the next scene is them riding out of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
There's no minor's court. There's no reaction from the brothers at the judge Judge Tolliver's decision or anything, which I was fully expecting the first time I saw the movie. But they just avoid that altogether.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, in the interest of moving it along, if it's part of a double feature, maybe that scene was shot and cut out. It, you know, this is this is an old film that doesn't have a lot of, that's not been released in any way. There's not a lot of historical information available on it. So, you know, who knows if they actually shot that or not. But, yeah, I mean, I wanted to see it. I mean, you know, the movie all moves real quick, but even that, I wanted a little more. It doesn't need it. You know what happens. But again, it's just interesting. And yeah, like, now, would, do you think that Steven Judd, the Joel McRae character, would have signed off on this tactic?
No.
Yeah, so he probably wasn't aware of it.
No.
I think that's a dramatic.
I get that.
Well.
I get that from the very beginning that Randolph Scott's working on his own.
Yeah, and it's pragmatic and disrespective of the letter of the law or whatever you know color of law flies in you know this unincorporated mining camp.
Right.
But would Joel McRae value the unincorporated mining camp's views on these things? I don't know.
He said no. He said they'd abide by the decision
That's
of
right.
the court.
That's right. They did. Yeah.
So
you need a guy who moves in the gray area to just get this over quickly.
<That's>
Expedient
right.
solution. So, yeah, they're off. We find out as they're leaving. You know, when they're talking about back in the day, that Steven Judd used to be in the Hole in the Wall gang.
That's
an aside. That's just tossed off like nothing. I thought that was great. It's like, whoa, really? Like Butch Cassidy? That gives him another layer too. That's
not really explored. Yeah.
No. Not at all. But it's intriguing. So I'm gonna get to the point here where okay, we're gonna have to act. And, you know, as guys planning to steal this gold, it's time for us to actually steal the gold. And yeah, Heck at this point has been impressed with how, Joel McRae operates. So he's like, I don't feel good about this. And Randolph Scott turns like stony. He's just like, nope, we're going to do it without him. You know, no other way. I've been talking to him and I'm sure we're just going to steal this. And, you know, he can take care of the farmer's daughter, and that'll be fine. And we'll abscond. And he catches him in the act of stealing it. Says he's going to take him to prison. Gives him the chance to throw down, like, you know. It's like,
that's right.
You want to trust me? And Randolph Scott demurs.
Yep. Which, the first time I saw it, I was a little disappointed that there wasn't some, either a fist fight or,
this fight would have been nice.
Yeah.
It's, there has not been an action scene in this film. And we're about an hour and 15 minutes in at this point.
Yeah. And yet,
doesn't feel like it.
Seems to move along pretty well.
Oh, it moves very, very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so they're headed back to civilization with, Gil and Heck have their wrist-bound riding horses in. And he's going to take them over to Law and Order, take them to jail when they get back. And then they run into Billy and Hammond and his brother Warren Oates. And they're like, hey, turns out we're not done with this movie. We're gonna take her back, And then there's that gunfight.
Well, they had, in the meantime, gotten to the judge and gotten the truth out of the judge after beating him up.
Right, they do. They beat the judge up.
That's beat up the judge and get the truth out of him, and so they go after him. But now it's more, I get the sense that they're doing more than going after the woman. They're going after the gold as well. Even though they say all we want's the woman.
Yeah. Do they even know? Well, I guess they must know.
Yeah, that's why they came. That's why they went to the gold camp.
Yeah. All right. Exactly. I mean, they got his name on a sign there, like, you know, Steve Judd will be in charge of this money, and yeah,
presumably. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they kill them and take the girl, then yeah, they're definitely taking the gold too.
Right. Right.
Uh-huh. And yeah, so that leads to the big gunfight. You know, it's the style that you see gunfights in at this period in time. It's, you know, kind of getting the drop on people by maneuvering around rock bluffs and cliff sides.
Right.
And I wouldn't say any of the action in this film is particularly thrilling, but it's, you know, it's competent. Serviceable.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Competent. They take most of them out, you know, even without Gil, who he refuses to untie Gil to help, even though he lets Heck. He unties Heck, but refuses to untie Gil to assist, which is confidence.
Yeah. So Gil manages to get one of the Hammond boys,
mm-hmm.
right, kill him, and take his rifle.
Yeah.
Left his horse there, which proves to be important later on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But takes back the rifle, and they scare him off this time.
Yeah. And, yeah, and then they're headed back. They're going to drop off the girl at her father's house. Heck says something here, which is, you know, that Gil's tied up, and Heck, you know, helped Joel McRae out, and he says, like, oh, yeah, I never figured it would end up like this, and I was like, yeah, I agree. This is not where I saw this film going. This is this is pretty interesting, and then it turns out that Dad has been killed by the brothers. Oh, right. But before that, Gil gets away before that, doesn't he?
That's right.
Randolph Scott rides off. He kind of takes advantage of an opportunity and leaves.
He splits mm-hmm. and he goes and gets the Hammond brothers' horse,
mm-hmm.
the guy that was killed by Heck, and takes off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and presumably to leave the film, or, you know, so we are meant to think, but, you know.
Well, or show up later on to try and get the gold again.
Yeah, well, certainly possible, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they show up at the farmer's house, R.G. Armstrong farmer's place, and he has been killed by the Hammonds. They're going to, they've snuck into the house and they're going to ambush them there. And this is the end of the film. This is the big final shootout.
Yep.
Which, and they have the drop on them. They're hiding behind like an arroyo kind of, There's no real good route to victory for them, and then Gil rides in, and like Han Solo, to come and help, and joins them, you know, in the final showdown, and jumps behind the into the ditch with them. And is like, oh well, what are we gonna do? He has a great bit where he plays possum on the way, pretends he got shot and falls down, and then just runs. I like that,
right.
But. And then it builds to a high noon shootout, basically, in the farmyard here, which is the two of them versus three of the three of the brothers. How come Heck wasn't with them, by the way?
He was shot.
Well, so was Joel Heck McRae.
Yeah. But it was the two older guys that just wanted to do it like the old days.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's the good guys versus the bad guys in a big old, you know...
Did you feel at this time that this shootout was a little contrived?
Well, not in a way that it... Okay, yes, in the sense that, like, there was no reason for the Hammond brothers to be, like, shamed into doing it.
That's what I'm referring to, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if you want to do it for real, why don't we just stop shooting at each other and face off like men or whatever.
Oh, one of the elder brother, right?
Yeah.
Wants to just wait for him and shoot him when they come mm-hmm. out. But
yeah, that is a guaranteed win for them, by the way.
Right. And Billy's character says, what about family honor? As if this group is really worried about family honor. I mean, they haven't showed anything to indicate family honor in the past.
They're bad characters. Of course they wouldn't care about that. That is contrived.
Yeah.
The actual shootout itself, I think, is pretty cool. And
I like the shootout. The ultimate shootout.
You know, the five people facing each other. And
like a gunfight at OK Corral or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a real O.K. Corral kind of thing. And it ends correctly, which is that everybody but one of them gets killed. Like, it's not just the good guys just win. No, everyone gets kind of messed up in this. And as it turns out, Randolph Scott survives, and Jill McRae takes the loss there. And he is shot down, and he has a dying scene, you know. And Randolph Scott promises, "Oh, I'm gonna do just how you would have done. I'm gonna take that gold back, just how you would have done. So long, partner." And he just drops down and dies, and the end credits are there immediately. Like,
well, he tells him he wants to die alone. He doesn't want them to see him like this. He just wants to die alone.
Yeah, he waves the others off, right? Mm-hmm. I thought he was going to blow his own head off. I thought that was what he was going to do.
I guess he was fading fast.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he had been shot like 3 times.
Yeah, and the last scene is cutting from him falling over and raising up with the mountains. Same scene we get at the beginning of the movie with the mountains in the back. Yeah. But this is like paying homage to the old days, where he was free, out in the wilds.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a good ending.
I like the ending.
So in the end, I mean, I thought this was a very good film. I really liked it. How many stars, 1 out of 5, would you give Ride the High Country?
You know, I just like this movie. I like Randolph Scott in this movie probably more than any other Randolph Scott movie, except maybe 7 Men from Now. But
he's well used.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that for both these guys it was kind of their swan song.
Yeah.
As Western stars. Yeah, that is a thing. Uh-huh. As well as the characters, you know, they play.
Yeah.
And I like the story. I thought it was great. The performances were good. I'd give it 4 stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a good entry into the aging gunslinger, you know, subgenre.
Yeah.
It is good. Good use of Randolph Scott. I enjoyed him very much. In the context of now, I think I'm giving it 3.5. I think because it never particularly carried me over the hill into being really enthusiastic about it in a way that some of these movies do sometimes. I can't think of anything that I didn't like about this or that I thought was a problem particularly. It just didn't quite have that, I don't know, that Last Train to Gun Hill kind of, you know. I didn't have quite the enthusiasm for it that I did for some others, but... that could have simply come down to the mood I was in when I watched it. I thought it was very good. I thought it was an entertaining 1962 film. It's everyone comes off very well in it. Sam Peckinpah, first real Western he did. That's pretty cool. And, it's good. And a fan of the genre or Randolph Scott or of this era, it's a fine entry. And I'm really glad that we did it because I like finding these films that I've never heard of before that really play. And this one has its fans for sure. Like some people are very into this, you know. I mean, for it not being a film that's thought of or spoken of too often, it has a cult following, I think. Good movie, really strong in a lot of respects, and doesn't go at all the way you would expect it to. I would say, figuring out what kind of film it was part of the fun of it, you know.
Yeah.
What, and that stuff with the brothers, you know, that long sequence with the marriage at the brothel, it's a pretty remarkable sequence in a sort of indefinable way. What else have you seen of late, Dad?
You know, I've been watching stuff on the Western Channel.
Oh, just well, that's old, perfect.
Old B westerns. Saw one with George Montgomery the other day. Missed the first part of it. In fact, I can't even remember the title of the movie, but George Montgomery was huge back in the 50s and 60s. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
You there?
Yes, I'm here.
And it was It was very formulaic, and he was trying to convince an Indian chief to accept the treaty, the conditions of the treaty, and of course, there were a couple of white men that killed a couple of Indians and sparked a raid, and
it happens. Yeah.
It happens, yeah.
In a lot of these, actually.
But yeah, just been watching the Western Channel.
Well, that's great.
I don't get out to the theater much anymore.
Yeah, well,
it's finding somebody to go with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, force Torben.
Yeah.
Ronnie's not Vero. Not crazy about the kind of movies released in the summer. I would expect.
True.
You can take him to Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman's fun. Everyone likes Wonder Woman a lot. It's a good one.
Okay.
I mean, it's not breaking any new ground. I think people tend to overpraise it a little bit, you know, considering what it is. But it's a.
Who plays Wonder Woman?
What's that?
Who plays Wonder Woman?
Ah, well, that's the thing. It's an Israeli actress named Gal Gadot, who is perfect in the way that Christopher Reeve was perfect for Superman. It is you know, it is the character walking right out of a comic book onto the stage and or the screen, and that is what is most effective about the movie. Is just that, you know, they got the right person for the role, and that's really cool to see. I mean, she just looks it, you know, 100%. You know, cool. Radiates the energy of the character from the beginning, and that's kind of why I think people are really into this film. As a film itself, I think it's, you know, I think it's solid. I think it's a good movie. It's kind of a restatement of movies that have, you know, of the that you've already seen, or I don't know if you've already seen,
genre.
But like superhero films, like it's almost a cross between the first Thor movie and the first Captain America movie. Like almost exactly, that's what it is. So if you've seen other of those, it's like that. And it's, you know, takes place during World War I instead of World War II. You know, stuff like little changes to make it kind of, I guess, its own thing.
But
it's good, and she's really good. And it's nice to see the DC characters treated well, because they've been making bad movies with them for a while. So that's nice.
Yeah. All right.
It's solid, good movie, Wonder Woman. You know, cool. It would be a similarly good as you know what, I'm babbling at this point. It's a good movie. Okay, so I believe
coming
that
up.
Does it for us this week, right?
Yep. What's coming up?
Oh man, Dad, I am so excited about this next episode. I've been wanting to do this for a while. I was never sure how it would work, and we've gotten to a point where we're going to do it. It's going to be, next episode is going to be the first season of the HBO show Deadwood. We're going to be talking about Deadwood next week, or next time on this. The first season in particular, you know, we don't want to do the whole thing. That's too much to do in one episode. So we'll be talking about season one, starring Ian McShane and Timothy Oliphant. This is one of my favorite things of all time. I'm so excited to talk about this with you, Dad. That will be on the next episode of Westerns with Dad. You can reach us online at westernswithdad@gmail.com or the website westernswithdad.com. And please send us if you have requests for episodes to do, if you have any questions you would like us to answer on the air, anything you'd like us to address on the podcast, please send it to that email address, and we will respond to it in the next episode. Also, please visit us on iTunes and leave reviews and ratings for us, because they increase the profile of the podcast. We really appreciate all the downloads. It's been very edifying to see this get an audience. So thank you very much.
And, I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. And so we'll see you next time for Deadwood Season 1.
All right. Adios, amigos.